Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Like many of you, we are monitoring the horrible tragedy that took place in Boston yesterday, and because there is no new information, we decided to stick with our original show today, and we will most likely discuss media coverage on Friday. So today, we are going to talk about President Obama's $3.7 trillion fiscal year 2014. It was released last week, and it's essentially a blueprint for the president's priorities. Now, most of the attention has been focused on his proposed cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits, but it also calls for more investment in infrastructure and early childhood education. But what else is in this budget? It's 244 pages. How would it affect investment in infrastructure and job creation? What about taxes? It also affects almost anything you can name. We're talking about science, rivers, drugs. There's just so much in this budget. So on today's show, we're continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the budget. What questions do you have, and do you know how your tax dollars are spent? Today, we're joined by Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst at the National Priorities Project, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible so we can all prioritize and influence how our tax dollars are spent. Mattia is the lead author of the NPP's book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and she joins us from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mattia. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Andrew Fieldhouse, Federal Budget Policy Analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank that seeks to broaden the public debate about strategies to achieve a prosperous and fair economy. And Andrew joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me back on.
Great to have you back. So, Mattia, like so many people, I ran to the post office yesterday at about 4:35 to send my check to the IRS. And it just got me really thinking because we're doing this budget show today and it's so massive. And you all do such a good job of breaking down how our taxes are actually spent. When it comes to federal income taxes, do most people know where their tax dollars go?
No, not at all. I think on that, when they're racing to the post office on April 15th, I think to most people it feels like they're sending a check into a black hole. You know, they never hear anything back, certainly, about where that money goes, and they have no idea. And our democracy is the worst for it.
And I'm looking right now at your graphic, and I love how you do this. It just puts it all in perspective. You've got military, 26.5 cents, healthcare, 20 cents, food and agriculture, 4.4 cents, housing, 4 cents, education, 3.5 cents, transportation, a measly 1.4 cents, science, 1 cent. So does this come directly from the budget?
This is how the federal government, yes, it does, and the White House releases this information each year, but not in such a way that's accessible to Americans. And so what we do is we separate out spending, different kinds of federal spending, to isolate exactly where our federal income taxes go, because that's a bit different from other kinds of federal spending, and we sort it into these categories so that they're relatively intuitive and folks can say, now I see exactly where my tax dollars are spent by down to the penny.
The National Priorities Project has done such a good job of trying to start a conversation about where our taxes go, because it really is all about priorities. But Andrew, why do you think we don't hear it this way? I mean, at a time when this budget is being released, it seems like this would, and Tax Day was yesterday, this is a great time to really look at priorities. For example, why do we spend 3.5 cents for every tax dollar on education while spending 26.5 cents on the military?
Well, the U.S. budget process has become mired in total political dysfunction. Hmm. And it's important to note that there are some differences in this president's budget, and it's definitely more conservative than his fiscal year 2013 budget, which was his most progressive. But nothing like the president's first four budget requests have been enacted, and you do have a kind of a stalemate on budget policy between House Republicans and Senate Democrats and the administration. So while a budget is your reflection on priorities and an incredibly important document, this will not go anywhere. There are certain proposals like chain CPI, Social Security cuts that Republicans will be attracted to. But overall, this is not going to become legislative text and be enacted through Congress. So you have to take this more as a strategic document. It is a gambit for forcing negotiations with Republicans over replacing sequestration with better policy savings. And it's also a sort of statement of values by the administration that they're willing to compromise on certain policy priorities in order to come up with a better deal that they like better than sequestration.
So it's really a starting point, but it also does send a very strong message, as you said, about the president's priorities, right?
Ironically, the message here is that after winning re-election and referendum for the policies you want, he's tacked definitely more to the conservative side. And this is the most conservative budget he's put out.
So you said 2013 was his most progressive. This one, the 2014 budget, is his most conservative. What are the major changes between the two?
So I think of it in three policy bins. First off, the president has proposed less than ambitious revenue targets. The president has somewhat abandoned the American Jobs Act. There's still money for upfront stimulus for infrastructure investment, a little bit of aid to state governments and some tax credits, but there's much less than what he was proposing in the fall of 2011, barnstorming the country. It's a watered-down version of the American Jobs Act.
Can we stick with that for a minute? Because this is
sure.
So important with such a high unemployment rate. And, you rarely hear about the American Jobs Act at all anymore. So talk about the changes and what does this mean for people looking for work?
Well, this package is directly into tax day. Yesterday, Americans realized that they owed more in tax, but for the vast majority of Americans, that was not the individual income tax. It was the expiration of the payroll tax cut that had been in place for 2011 and 2012 that's responsible for 98% of the fall in disposable income for households making under $200,000 a year. That's the vast majority of households, 96%. And the payroll tax cut was very targeted a stimulus. He proposed it in 2011, extracted it in a lame duck deal in December 2010, and then proposed an even bigger version. It would have risen from 2 percentage points to 3.2 percentage points in his fiscal 2013 budget and the American Jobs Act, and that's been dropped. And the payroll tax cut alone was pumping about $115 billion into the U.S. economy. We estimated that its expiration will shave 0.9 percentage points off of real GDP growth this year. That's a big hit.
And let me just ask you, Mattia, do you agree with Andrew that the 2013 budget was President Obama's most progressive and this one is his most conservative?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, we saw some things in his 2014 budget. The Social Security cuts, certainly. The fact that he proposes no new revenue from corporations, I think that took many on the left by surprise. So I would certainly say that this document taxed to the right, absolutely.
Can you talk more about that? Because Social Security and Medicare are getting the most attention, we're hearing a little bit about revenue, but it's framed in such a way that he did this to appease the conservatives so he can get more revenue, but it kind of stops at that point. So when you say no new revenue from corporations, none at all?
None at all, and that's the cornerstone of his plan. So what the president proposes is corporate tax reform, namely closing some loopholes for corporations. He leaves this door open to tax reformers in Congress, but he proposes essentially closing loopholes in the corporate tax code in a revenue-neutral fashion, meaning that he would use new revenue raised from closing loopholes to just simply lower corporate tax rates, and therefore corporations overall would pay not any more, not one dime more, in corporate income tax, but would benefit from a simpler tax code. And certainly, I think many people agree our tax code should be simpler. There's much disagreement about whether or not corporations should be made to pay more in taxes. And I think that President Obama has alienated many of his supporters on the left with this proposal.
Can you talk a little bit more about taxes and put this into context for us? Because the other thing that the National Priorities Project has done so well is to look at what the tax cuts cost, the Bush-Obama extension tax cuts. And that really also is not part of this conversation when we're talking about taxes. So when you look at the total cost from 2001 to 2021, we're talking about $3.2 trillion, the Bush tax cuts coupled with the Obama extension. Can you put that into context with this budget?
Well, $3.2 trillion. Let's see, what's the best context for that? So right now, you know, debt and deficit continue to be a top conversation in Washington, right? That's the frame through which we're looking at all budget proposals, for better or worse, in Washington. Right now, in order to meet the deficit reduction targets put out by Simpson-Bowles, for instance, which is largely considered a sort of gold standard for those in the center, I think, on deficit reduction. We only need about, I believe it's about $2 trillion in additional deficit reduction to enact it over a decade, and so and that would put our budget deficit on a budget deficits on a sustainable path. In other words, $3 trillion is substantially more than that. That's a huge, vast sum of money, far more than we need in deficit reduction over the coming decade. So it's a big enough sum of money to turn around our whole fiscal picture for the next decade.
And Andrew, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that this should be included in the conversation about the budget? I'm talking about these tax cuts.
Oh, absolutely. All budget policy has to be based on economic and recent context. And we have the backdrop of the Bush tax cuts reducing revenues below levels that will be adequate for the retirement of the baby boomers and the rise in per capita health care costs, which we have to contain. And the Affordable Care Act begins to experiment with that. But it will be a long process. And it's important to note that it's much easier to turn tax policy quickly than it is to turn federal spending programs. Mm-hmm. When people look at cuts to Medicare or Social Security or changing anything about Medicaid, they typically grandfather in anyone who is within a decade from the retirement age. Now, these big federal programs are not going to be able to be turned quickly. So tax policy is a more dynamic variable in addressing fiscal responsibility over the long term, but it also has to account for the fact that we don't have nearly enough revenue. And this is unfortunate, but President Obama's campaign pledge not to raise taxes on households earning under $250,000 in 2008 really constrained what he can do on the revenue front. And I don't think that the revenue levels proposed in any of his five budgets would come close to what's realistically needed. I think you need to see revenue on the order of 21% of GDP for the 21st century and to get through 2037 and the hump of the retirement of the baby boomers.
I was listening to a talk by economist Richard Wolff recently, and he said that for every dollar citizens paid in taxes in the 30s, corporations paid $1.50. And today, for every dollar that citizens pay in taxes, corporations pay 25 cents. So it's gone from $1.50 down to 25 cents. What explains President Obama's decision not to get new revenue from corporations? Do you have any insights about what went on behind the scenes, Andrew?
Well, Mattia's absolutely right that he's proposed less. It's about $95 billion of policy savings that would be diverted to lowering the top tax rate. The administration had put out sort of a very loose, broad principles document for corporate tax reform. And I think there is a sense that corporate tax reform is much more likely to happen than individual income tax reform, which is quite complicated. I do think that there are some real constraints to how much revenue you can raise from the corporate income tax relative to what we were raising back in the 1930s or even the 1950s and 1960s. And that's in large part because the base of the corporate income tax base has largely been shifted over to the individual income tax base. In the aftermath of the 1986 tax reforms, you saw a lot of businesses realize that reorganizing from C corporations that pay the corporate income tax to pass-through entities, partnerships, and S corporations could actually face lower tax liability. So if you want to raise as much revenue as we were from businesses, part of that's going to have to be raising more revenue from the individual income tax side. And right now we're trying to recoup a tiny fraction of the revenue lost from the Bush-era tax cuts, let alone nothing from changes in the tax base over the last quarter century.
You know, I think this is important because you have a lot of people and some politicians like Bernie Sanders saying that corporations should pay their fair share. At a time when profits are off the charts, we often see studies that corporations pay very little taxes and that they put so much money overseas. So when you hear these conversations, Andrew, what do you think is, I mean, what sounds right to you, and when do you shake your head and say that's just not true? Because this does get quite a lot of attention, especially in the alternative media, and a lot of people talk about this.
Sure. You do have to look at international tax competitiveness, and you do have to look at interactions with job creation. The part of the corporate tax code that I think makes the least amount of sense is the voluntary deferral of U.S. multinational corporations' foreign earnings. They can decide when they repatriate foreign income. Best estimates, they're sitting on some $1.8 trillion abroad. They can choose when to bring it back and subject it to the U.S. corporate income tax rate, currently 35% less credits for taxes paid to foreign governments. Unfortunately, this creates a rather perverse incentive where you can choose to plunk your money in a low-tax country like Ireland and never repatriate and use earnings from Ireland to reinvest in Ireland. So you're shifting investment from the United States abroad. And if you ended deferral and reformed treatment of international tax credits for taxes paid to foreign governments, you could bring back a ton of revenue to the United States, and you would actually have pretty substantial impacts on domestic investment preferred over foreign investment. That makes a lot of sense to me. Spending $95 billion to lower the corporate income tax rate just a tiny bit doesn't make very much sense. And if you did actually do full-blown corporate tax reform and lowered the top corporate tax rate closer to the effective corporate tax rate, or what businesses are paying on average at 25%, you wouldn't raise any revenue. You'd create some winners and losers. But I don't think there are major efficiency gains to be had. Oftentimes, people talk about corporate tax reform in the name of job creation. You have to remember that these sort of supply-side tax policies, lower tax rates are good for growth, are very small and only begin to manifest themselves very far out in the future in the context of full employment. Nothing about corporate tax reform is going to have a substantial near-term demand boost, which is what you need to get the unemployment rate down, which still has to be the top economic priority.
And Mattia, anything else you'd like to add about corporate taxes before we move on to other issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Individual income taxes right now comprise just under 50% of all federal tax revenue. So corporate income taxes, about 12%. Mm. That's a huge difference. And our payroll taxes are the next largest share after individual income taxes. So Social Security and Medicare taxes are about a third of all federal tax revenue. So corporate income taxes come in as a distant third after our income taxes and our payroll taxes. I think that gives some context to ordinary Americans looking at their pay stubs.
And what's your reaction when you hear people say corporations need to pay their fair share because they're putting so much money overseas and they're paying such low taxes? We're talking about multinationals specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Americans are right to feel that right now our tax code in many ways is a sort of playground for the very wealthy and for corporations that have talent at accountants and can figure out how to minimize their tax liability. And of course, ordinary Americans have nothing like that opportunity. You know, we pay our taxes. We struggle, in fact, to figure out how much we owe and get that check in on April 15th. And there's absolutely a sense in which the system is not rigged in the favor of the ordinary American, and that corporations have been able to figure out how to pay a continually smaller share of federal tax revenue.
That is Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst at National Priorities Project, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to making the complex federal budget transparent and accessible so we can prioritize and influence how our tax dollars are spent. Andrew Fieldhouse is Federal Budget Policy Analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank that seeks to broaden the public debate about these issues. And on today's Your Call, we wanted to talk about the budget and also tax day because they're completely connected, and really make sense of it and go beyond the headlines to kind of drill down, find out what goes on behind the scenes. Again, this is basically the president's blueprint. It's a reflection of his priorities. But as Andrew said, it's going to be drastically changed in the House and the Senate. So are you following this issue? What questions do you have about the budget and how this thing is put together. We're talking 244 pages. What questions do you have about what's in it? Here's just a couple things. The budget includes $300 million for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. I haven't heard that anywhere. It's receiving $7.6 billion for the National Science Foundation. You've got cybersecurity. The budget allocates more than $13 billion to cyber programs, nearly 16% of federal IT budget, totaling $82 billion. So we've got two experts on today's show who really look at this issue very, very closely. What questions do you have about the budget, the process, and do you know how your tax dollars are spent? Again, 26.5 cents for military, 1 cent for science, 1.4 cents for transportation, and 3.5 cents of every dollar on education. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And before we go to calls, Mattia, because National Priorities Project wants to influence or wants people to feel empowered to influence how their tax dollars are spent, what is the best way to go about that? Because like so many people, when I wrote my check to the IRS, I thought, gosh, I wish I could at least check a box to say how I want this money spent.
Well, you know, there is talk about that, about how Americans could feel more engaged in paying taxes. You know, can you choose to allocate a certain share of your taxes to, you know, your own priorities? I think that that's something that is getting a bit more, you know, I think in the democracy field, you know, those kinds of initiatives are attracting a bit more attention. But I think we're far out from seeing that affected in our government. So the question is, what can we do right now? And Americans in general feel powerless, I think, to influence what's happening in Washington. But in fact, we all can have an influence just by being in touch with our elected officials. People think that they can't make a difference, that legislators aren't listening. But in fact, legislators have legislative aides who keep track of constituent sentiment, and they absolutely do pay attention. And the National Priorities Project, we talk about what would this world look like if more Americans or all Americans were in touch on a regular basis with their elected officials about their priorities for this country. I think this country would look very different.
And Andrew, is now the time to speak out on the budget? If you disagree with a section of the budget, what should we do?
Well, elected officials in appropriations committees are going to have the next step in the budget process. And, you know, I mean, of course, in the past couple of years, we haven't had much of a budget process to speak of. It's been basically off the rails. But the legislators who are in charge of assigning dollar amounts to all the federal programs under the sun are appropriations committees. And so in particular, being in touch with legislators on appropriations committees is the most powerful, is the next step in the budget process. But all of us have representatives in Washington, whether they're on appropriations committees or not, and being in touch with them about our priorities can make a difference and absolutely will.
And what would you add to that, Andrew?
Well, I mentioned earlier that the president's budget will not get enacted. It's almost guaranteed that the House budget resolution and the Senate budget resolution will not be merged together in a conference. The two parties are on very, very different grounds on major questions about tax and spending. That said, the committees in charge of the major portions of the federal budget are going to be getting a lot of flack going into 2013, not so much because of the proposals in the president's budget, but because the sequestration cuts that went into effect March 1st will continue to ramp up. And I think if constituents speak out to committees, members of Congress, about sequestration, particularly as federal agencies start furloughing people, as funding for NIH and common sense programs start to get cut, when you cut the IRS budget, which is actually bad for tax revenue. And remember, these are designed to be cuts that were so undesirable that they could never be implemented, and we're still implementing them. So I think if pressure mounts on Congress to replace sequestration with something more sensible, then you do have a real opportunity in 2013 to weigh budget priorities and come up with something that is more programmatically feasible to be phased in, but also less economically damaging because sequestration is very front-loaded.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking about the budget. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
If you'd like to join in today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Please let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always love to hear new voices contributing to the program. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Don't forget, Sunday, May the 5th, at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House, David Sedaris, sharing an evening of all new readings and recollections in celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. David Sedaris at the War Memorial Opera House, Sunday, May the 5th. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about decision-making when it comes to pregnancy and childbirth. Cesarean births are on the rise. At the same time, there's a growing movement toward working with midwives and giving birth at home. So how do we make it so that families can make informed, free choices in their childbirth process? That is tomorrow. And again, we are monitoring yesterday's horrific tragedy in Boston. Because there is no new information, we decided to stick with our original plan to talk about President Obama's budget today. We will possibly talk about coverage on Friday if things change, but we'd love to hear from you. How do you think yesterday's tragedy should be covered? You can email that as well as story or show ideas to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by drilling down into President Obama's 2014 $3.7 trillion budget. It's massive, 244 pages. We noticed that Social Security and Medicare are getting the most attention. But what about other issues like revenue from corporations? As we heard from today's guest, there is no new revenue from corporations. We're going to talk about what else is in there. It affects almost every issue you can name: infrastructure, early childhood education, rivers, science, the whistleblowers department within the federal budget, the military. So if you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. And then, of course, this is directly connected to Tax Day, which was yesterday. Do you know how federal income taxes, how your dollars are actually spent? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the budget and the process? And now is the time to speak out. So what would you like to say about this budget? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Mattia Kramer is Senior Research Analyst with the National Priorities Project, and Andrew Fieldhouse is Federal Budget Policy Analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I have a question that may be a little bit off topic, but I wanted, if the guests knew what they were talking about, which I suspect they do, they would be able to help me out. I've been trying for the past couple days to make sense in a layperson set a language for what change CPI actually means, because I have a vested interest in the cuts to Social Security and Medicare. It's my impression, they can correct me if I'm wrong, that if you have a basket of goods that includes how much you're paying your babysitter, sneakers, a toaster, gasoline for your car, various goods and services, that the regular CPI would compute how much the cost of that basket has increased. Let's say it costs $100, and then over X period of time, it now costs $110. So it's gone up 10%, and that would be what the CPI is. I'm under the impression that the change CPI means that if the price of gas goes up, instead of computing that in the inflation, they're going to compute if people decide, oh, well, you know, the price of gas has gone up, so I'm going to change my mode of transportation and take BART to work instead of my car. And if the price of name brand clothing has gone up at Nordstrom, I'm not going to buy my shirt or my work clothes there. I'm going to go to Target instead. And so that's what they're going to chain. So obviously the inflation rate there would be lower. And I have no idea if I'm even close to understanding what the change CPI means.
Well, you're definitely not alone, Ruth Ann, so thank you for calling in. Mattia, you've been following this very closely. Can you answer Ruth Ann's question?
Sure.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. Thank you for that great question. Actually, Ruthanne, I think you have a very good handle on what change CPI means. It's exactly that. It's a different way of calculating inflation to allow for substitutions between goods so that to model the way consumers actually behave, you know, choosing lower-cost substitutes where they're available. Now, there are reasons to think that change CPI might be a smart way to calculate inflation for the economy as a whole, but the issue in terms of Social Security is whether or not change CPI is the right inflation measure for the relevant population, and in particular for retirees. And there's actually reason to think that change CPI is, in fact, not a smart way to measure inflation for retirees, since so much of their income goes to healthcare costs and to housing. And in fact, retirees may experience inflation at a higher rate than their general population, not at a lower rate. And so that's why many people talk about change CPI simply as a cut to benefits, because it doesn't necessarily enhance our understanding of inflation, but would certainly reduce benefits for senior citizens.
And a lot of people have been asking about numbers. Social Security Works crunched the numbers in the budget, and this is what they came up with. And I'd love for you to tell me if this sounds right to you. So we're talking about a change CPI benefit cut for an average worker retiring at age 65. By the age of 75, the annual cut because of the change CPI would be $648. At the age of 85, it would be $1,147. And the age of 95, $1,622. And this is a year. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds like it's in the right ballpark. I don't know, Andrew, if you want to weigh in.
Andrew? No, that sounds like it's in the right ballpark.
Okay, so basically, by the time you reach 75, if this chain CPI goes into effect, you'll essentially be losing $658 a year. And at 85, $1,147 a year. Is that right, Andrew?
Right. The administration's built in what they've called birthday bumps. I believe at 76 and then 86. But you'd see small increases, about $750, 5% of average earnings at those ages. The problem is, if you're decreasing the cost of living adjustment, the benefit cut compounds with every year, just as a retiree is drawing down savings and often health care expenditure is going up. So sort of the phase-in of this cut is a little perverse, and they've tried to account for that, but even with the birthday bump, quote-unquote, it is a real benefit cut. And it's not a technical fix, as Ms. Tia said. The cost of living of the elderly, they do actually have like an experimental elderly CPI, is much higher because the consumption basket is predominantly healthcare, energy, and housing, and there's much less degree of substitutability in the healthcare sector and the energy sector than, say, retail consumption of clothing.
So you can understand why people are concerned, because if you're making $800 to $900 a month on Social Security and you're looking at a possible $1,200 to $1,600 a year cut, that's a lot of money.
Oh, it is. And it's bad Social Security policy at a broader level. Back in the 2000s, there was sort of a realization, long deserved, that the problem with long-term federal spending was entirely being driven by the rise in per capita healthcare costs,
right,
which is a result of a very fragmented healthcare system with partial public, partial private, and the public provision of healthcare has done a much better job holding down private costs. The Affordable Care Act starts to get at that, but the problem is entirely healthcare, particularly Medicare. Social Security has an increase in expenditure projected because you do have more people retiring into the program. But the actuaries got this dead on in the Greenspan Commission back in the 1980s. And we've known that there was going to be a level shift up, about one percentage point of GDP of Social Security expenditure. What the actuaries got wrong was the rise in income inequality. Social Security has collected much less than they were projecting during the 1980s reforms, because the Social Security tax base is capped at a certain income level. Right now it's about $113,000 for an individual. And that's indexed. It rises with prices. But you've seen an increase in the income share well above the cap. So the amount of economy-wide earnings subjected to the Social Security cap has fallen from about 90% to 84%. So Social Security has collected less, or last quarter century, than expected, and that's going to continue to be the trend. If you want to go about Social Security reform and keep it solvent without really hurting seniors, you have a very easy option, which is raising the amount of income subject to the cap, or even better from my perspective, just eliminating it.
And just quickly, Andrew, because you said this is the president's blueprint and this will definitely be changed, what are you hearing in Washington, D.C. specifically about the CPI and what's in store for its future?
So the day the president released his budget, the head of the NRCC, who's going to try and win more seats for the Republicans.
The National Republican Committee?
Yeah, campaign.
Right.
Announced that it was a vicious attack on seniors and that the administration was going after seniors. And simultaneously, Grover Norquist, who is sort of the blesser of GOP tax policy, announced that chain CPI would be a tax increase if implemented elsewhere. So the parameters of the individual income tax, the alternative minimum tax, other tax parameters are indexed to inflation. So if you replaced it with chain CPI, which grows about a quarter percentage point lower per year, your brackets rise more slowly, so more income rises faster, and you have what economists refer to as bracket creep. More gross income is taxed at higher levels over time. Overall, the president's budget would get about $130 billion from benefit cuts with chain CPI and about $100 billion of revenue. Republicans immediately bashed the benefit cut as a benefit cut, which it is, and ruled that the revenue side was a violation of their taxpayer protection pledge. It's definitely a gambit. Since then, Speaker Boehner has been more open to the possibility. They don't want to own Social Security cuts. They lost the House of Representatives because they did own Social Security cuts back in 2005. But this does seem like a big political liability to the president and the Democratic Party. And you also have to wonder what the Democrats would get for signing on to spending cut-only incremental Social Security reform. They're asking for a lot less revenue, and it seems unlikely that they would get any.
That's what a lot of progressive groups are asking right now. So thank you for that explanation, and I hope that helps Ruthann and all of you who are confused about CPI, because there are a lot of questions about what that actually means. And you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose. Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, and good morning to your guests, Andrew and Medea. Yeah, what Mr. Obama gets is he gets what Bill Clinton gets. He gets rich after he gets out of office by the business community. That's pretty simple. And when you guys talk about defense spending, only like a 25 cents on the dollar, that's obfuscated for the benefit of the White House. There's a lot more that goes into defense, especially VA costs, health care, and all the the chronic injuries that are caused. I think it's a lot higher than 25 cents. And I don't know why you guys aren't talking about the Progressive Caucus, the back-to-work budget. That budget raises $4.2 trillion in revenues. It has a transaction tax of $352 billion over 10 years. It fills in tax loopholes like carried interest, which is killing us on Wall Street. It fills in the oil subsidies. And it creates six tax brackets above $250,000. And this budget will create 7 million jobs, whereas Obama's budget loses us 790,000 jobs. Obama's budget only creates like $1.2 trillion in revenue over 10 years, whereas the back-to-work budget creates $4.2 trillion. And this 84 members of the House voted for this. Nancy Pelosi did not. Jackie Speier did not. But this is the budget we need. Cuts defense and reduces the deficit by $4.4 trillion. This is what we should be talking about if you're a working people, and it has a big stimulus package. Hires police, unemployment extended, training, school funding, science, transportation of over $500 billion. This is the budget this country needs.
Well, thank you for calling, Andy. I actually was going to get there, but we've got an hour and we've got a lot of things to talk about. So you brought up many, many points here, the military and the progressive budget. And I would venture to guess that most people don't even know about this because it barely got attention. And Mattia, we mentioned this a couple of months ago. Business Insider polled registered voters and asked for their preference among Paul Ryan's budget, Obama's budget, and the progressive budget. And they overwhelmingly voted for the progressive budget, even the Republicans, because they didn't label it, which was fascinating. But what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think that Andy had his numbers right when he kind of went over the progressive caucus budget?
Yeah, well, first, and let's just address Andy's question about military spending. So he notes the Progressive Caucus would reduce military spending. Right now, about a quarter of our federal income taxes go to the military, and that includes does not include veterans' benefits, as Andy pointed out. And another 4.3 cents would go to veterans' benefits. But by and large, that 25 cents does include most things for the military, though it does not include Homeland Security, which might be what he was pointing out, and that Homeland Security funding is sort of hidden away in all different other areas of the federal budget. So I just wanted to address that point.
So when you do look at how much of every dollar goes to the military, according to your analysis, it's about 24.5%. That the War Resisters League says it's about 54 cents.
Sure, you can add in, they'll add in veterans' benefits, which we keep as a separate thing. The War Resisters League will also take interest on the federal debt and try to calculate how much interest we're paying on previous wars and previous military spending. But we very much stand by our calculation at 26.5 cents on each income tax dollar. That includes the Department of Defense base budget, as well as nuclear weapons at the Department of Energy and current war costs.
Okay, and we'll go a little, we have about 15 minutes left, but we will definitely speak more broadly about military spending. But any other thoughts on the progressive budget, and why do you think it really didn't get that much attention?
Yeah, so you brought up this great point about how Americans overwhelmingly supported the Progressive Caucus budget without knowing what it was, and even Republicans did. And I think that's because what's included in the Progressive Caucus budget are items that individually pull really well with Americans. For instance, a lot of money for job creation. I mean, 99% of Americans, according to Gallup, want more money for job creation and the economy. Americans want more money for education spending. They want higher taxes on the wealthiest and corporations because, as we talked about before, there's a sense that taxes right now are not fair, that the wealthiest sort of get a free ride in some sense. And so these individual policies pull really well with the American public, and they're all included in the Progressive Caucus budget, and far less so in President Obama's budget, and certainly even less so in Paul Ryan's budget.
Right, and it would eliminate, to be exact, $278 billion in wasteful Pentagon spending. Anything else you want to add on that, Andrew, since this budget really didn't get much attention?
I would actually disagree with you. but first, I should say I've worked with the Congressional Progressive Caucus to develop their last three budgets. I've helped them model, analyze, develop, and then write a technical analysis explaining how their budget adds up. So I'm pretty familiar with it and understand the history. I actually think they got a lot more traction in their fiscal 2014 budget than any other budget they've had, and I think it's fantastic that your caller knew that this was the budget that would be best reflect his policy priorities. I think initially there was a lot of focus on the Ryan budget and sort of pushback against the Ryan budget, but as the Ryan budget got exposed on the campaign trail in 2012 as somewhat of a fraudulent fantasy budget, it opened up an even playing field for the progressives. Their budget is very much the diametrically opposed budget to the Ryan budget. Neither will get enacted, but it's sort of a progressive wish list versus a conservative wish list. I think people started to realize that the progressive wish list is actually based in evidence-based economic analysis, what the country needs, how to solve problems, whereas the conservative wish list is just going back 100 years and social progress. And is completely like fiscally fraudulent. So I do think that you see a lot more of this. And if you go on the Washington Post, Wonk Blogs, analyses of the budgets from this cycle, the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget in every one of those compared with the Ryan budget, the Murray budget, and the Republican Study Committee budget, it's there. It's finally gotten a bit of an entrance into the
So I should spend more time on Wonk Blogs and maybe turn off the radio more often.
But
it's a different
inside the baseball game in D.C., but they've made inroads, and I think you'll see more from them in future years.
All right. So, again, this progressive budget, based on the money they would save by cutting the Pentagon, they say they would prevent 280,000 teacher layoffs, modernize 35,000 public schools, and make infrastructure investments. What about President Obama's budget on these issues? Let's just go over a couple things that people need to know about. How does his budget affect infrastructure, Mattia?
The president's budget has about $166 billion over a decade for job creation. That includes infrastructure repairs and some other job creation initiatives, including tax credits. So $166 billion, I mean, that's actually substantially larger than what we're likely to get enacted into law, but that's much, much smaller than, think about, $4.2 trillion in the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget.
Wow, it was $4.2 trillion. $4.2 trillion in the progressive and $166 billion in President Obama's for infrastructure.
Those are total job creation initiatives and largely through infrastructure investment, exactly.
Wow. I love those comparisons. Can you give us a few more?
Sure. Which are, revenue is another important area. You know, the president's budget includes less than $600 billion in new tax revenue, and that's largely through closing tax deductions in tax deductions and loopholes for the wealthiest individuals. The House Congressional Progressive Caucus budget has about $5.7 trillion in new tax revenue over 10 years. So again, about $600 billion in the president's budget and $5.7 trillion in new tax revenue over 10 years. So these are dramatically different plans, orders of magnitude different.
How many Democrats have signed on to this progressive budget, and have they spoken out against President Obama's budget?
Andrew, do you have the exact tally of folks who voted for the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget? I think that our caller said 83 votes in the House. Was that right?
Yeah. It's been a little bit over 80 each of the last 3 years. And it's pretty much the size of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
And do you know how California representatives lean on this one, Andrew? Maybe you can find that and we can put it on the website. Or if you find it by the end of the show, you can let us know.
Yeah, Barbara Lee is a very prominent member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and has been a big backer of the CPC budget.
Right, and probably
she's the one who really stands out.
And Maxine Waters.
Right, and Maxine Waters.
And now Lynn Woolsey's gone. Otherwise, she's usually in that trio also.
Right.
All right. Well, can you give us any more comparisons like Mattia just did about, you know, what else is in this budget that we need to know about?
Well, I think beyond comparing numbers to numbers, it's a matter of what you're trying to accomplish with tax policy. You don't try and balance the budget, or you shouldn't try and balance the budget, or you don't try and stabilize the debt level. It just as a matter of arithmetic. You have real policy priorities that you're trying to accomplish. And I think it's important to look at the way the Progressive Caucus budget would try and use government policy to push back against income inequality by actually raising top marginal tax rates, have a top 49% income tax rate over $1 billion. We know statistically that cuts in top marginal tax rates have had a statistically significant impact on the rising share of income captured by the top 0.1% and 0.100th percentile in the United States. They would use carbon pricing to push back against global warming. And if you really wanted to overhaul the U.S. infrastructure system, you need more than the $123 billion increase in the president's budget. They would fund over $1 trillion in new infrastructure spending in line with estimates of the American Society's civil engineers for what's actually needed to bring our infrastructure up to a passing grade. So I think it's a little bit more evidence-based, and if you take away the revenue constraint and allow progressive revenue to really fund your priorities, you can make a big push in the middle class instead of tinkering around the edges, which is in many ways what the Obama budget tends to do.
Well, I want to read a couple of emails. David writes, absolutely chain CPI is designed to miscalculate spending, assuming actual choices available to the seniors, and a, quote, basket misrepresents their actual spending. Bluntly put, even if you believed it was honestly calculated, the very purpose is to cut benefits. Since we've never seen consumer prices fall on any long-term basis, this is very clear. We also have an email from, let's see here, Carlton, who says, well, of course I know where my exorbitant taxes go. Education, healthcare, rapid public transportation, protecting the environment, etc., just as in every other industrialized, civilized country, right? What about, just quickly, public transportation? It's sad to see, Mattia, that only 1.4 cents of our dollar goes to public transportation. How does this budget affect public transit at a time when so many more people are taking public transportation?
Yeah, I mean, I think tinkering around the edges, unfortunately, is probably the right way to characterize it. There is some new money for transportation projects, but it's not anywhere near the amount needed, according to the Society for Civil Engineers, what we actually need to bring our infrastructure and transportation into the 21st century, investment in our long-term transportation goals, so that, as you're saying, Americans who are increasingly relying on public transportation, and for good reason, for high energy costs and because it's an efficient and environmentally friendly thing to do, this budget does not put money in transportation in the way that would be commensurate with those priorities in the 21st century.
And Jane writes in, regarding these egregious cuts, I wish someone would inform Congress and the president that the current philosophy of if the masses have no money to spend, the economy will soar, just doesn't work. Andrew, what are your thoughts on that?
She's right. If you were serious about long-term fiscal sustainability, the first thing you would try and do is get the U.S. economy out of a depression. It is in a depression right now. We're growing, but we're not growing fast enough to close a shortfall in aggregate demand of about $975 billion. Put differently, the U.S. economy is forfeiting about $1 trillion of national income every year. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that if you continue on the current austerity path, the economy will ever recover. And the longer you have mass underemployment, the more you're going to see income inequality widen, because when there's a lot of slack in the labor market, workers at the low end of the wage spectrum cannot demand real wage increases. And you've seen, since 2007, an incredibly skewed change in family income, the biggest drops in income, the lowest income quintiles. You're going to see income inequality skyrocket because of the failure to end the jobs crisis. And you're going to see more and more income concentrated at the very top. And it's exactly what's being discussed by your caller. You will have the middle class shrinking without much income, which is a real problem for a consumption-based economic structure.
Well, and Mattia, this is happening now. How much time do we have to actually speak out on this?
Well, we should speak out immediately, but it is always the right thing to do for us to be getting involved in a way that we haven't seen in recent years. We haven't seen the kind of engagement in, since the Great Recession started. We've seen policies that, besides, the Recovery Act initially, we haven't seen the policies, as Andrew's saying, that would give the economy the boost that Americans say they want. And so getting involved immediately, but then staying involved is absolutely the way to help turn the ship of state.
Just quickly, because there's so much at stake here, are you seeing more interest in this budget than you have in the past?
Absolutely. The budget issues have become a hot topic issue, and we're so glad to see Americans starting to turn to the federal budget as what it is, a blueprint for priorities, and looking for ways to have a say in what our national priorities are.
Mattia Kramer is Senior Research Analyst at National Priorities Project. Andrew Fieldhouse is the Federal Budget Policy Analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you both for joining us.
It's
a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar, and thank you for listening. How do parents make decisions about pregnancy and childbirth? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about childbirth choices. Cesarean births are on the rise, while at the same time, there's a growing movement toward working with midwives and giving birth at home. So how do we make it so that people can make informed, free choices in their childbirth process? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. If you're a parent-to-be, how are you figuring out what's best for you and your family? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.